You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a little later on today, the president is going to be giving his speech on home ownership and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all that sort of stuff. And we'll keep you up to date on what comes out of that. It looks like he's proposing basically doing away with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And I'm interested to see what the proposals are. I've got the fact sheet and all this stuff, but we'll see how this shakes out. In the meantime, the city of Detroit, where, you know, Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan, appointed, basically fired the democracy, said the elected officials have no more power. We're going to appoint a little dictator. This after the people of Michigan passed a ballot initiative, statewide ballot initiative, saying you can't do that. And then so they had to take down the original law that authorized that. So Snyder and his buddies brought back a new law to do that. And the Detroit Art Institute right now, which has an extraordinary art collection. Louise and I used to go there every Sunday when we lived in Detroit. SRF held Sunday services there. We'd go for those, and then we'd wander around the Art Institute. It was just an incredible place. They've hired Christie's to come appraise their, you know, the value of their collection. This is sort of like what happened in Benton Harbor, another poor community. There was, it's right next door to St. Joe, which is a very rich white community. Benton Harbor is a poor black community. They're on opposite sides of a river, and they're both on Lake Michigan on the other side of the state. And when Benton Harbor was failing, there was a park that in 1909, as I recall, had been given to the city of Benton Harbor by a very wealthy family. It was lakeside land worth a lot of money. And the family gave it to the city in memorial of their daughter who had died in childhood on the condition that it be kept a public park forever. But when the emergency manager came in, they said, screw that, we can make some money on this. They sold it to the golf course next door to it, which was able to expand this all the way up to the lake and thus increase the value of the golf course. And it's a golf course that pretty much services nobody but the white folks from the rich suburb. So here we have this privatization steamroller going on. And you know, one of the groups that thinks this is just a fine idea is the Reason Foundation, reason.org. And with us is Len Gilroy, the Director of Government Reform at the Reason Foundation, editor of Reason's annual report on privatization. And I'm guessing that's more of a cheerleading report than a condemnatory report. Len, welcome.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
First of all, am I wrong about anything I've said so far?
Well, I think you're wrong in the sense that it seems like you may be blaming privatization for some of the fiscal woes that cities are having.
No, not at all. Not at all. I'm saying that this is disaster capitalism. This is, you know, capitalism from time to time fails, and when it fails, it provides opportunities for predators. And you know, we had this failure of capitalism in 2008, the crash. And these cities were not collecting enough money. And as they've deindustrialized, they're collecting less and less. Detroit's a classic example of that. That has nothing to do with privatization. But the cities have these things called the commons, you know, water supplies, septic supplies, power systems in many cases, libraries, art museums, public parks. And the libertarian perspective on those things, correct me if I'm misrepresenting you, is that the city has no business having those things. Those should all be in the hands of billionaires.
Well, I think that's a mischaracterization, Tom.
How would you characterize it?
Well, I would characterize it by saying the libertarians are focused on limited governments that essentially focus on a few core things and let the private sector handle the scope of other things that are not core priorities of government.
How is that different than what I just said?
Well, I mean, you mentioned it as sort of putting in the hands of billionaires. But
right.
I could point to so many let me finish. I could point to so many examples of situations on things that you mentioned. For example, parks, libraries, other types of amenities that cities are used to having, in which one of the ways that cities have gone about trying to preserve those assets for the public good is by tapping the private sector through nonprofits, and other types of arrangements to have the private sector come in and essentially rescue some of these amenities because of the fiscal management that, or mismanagement that's going on among the policymakers is sort of streaming funds away from those priorities and mismanaging those funds.
So when a city mismanages their funds, to use your characterization, or when capitalism fails, to use mine, either case, you think it's a good thing that the billionaires are brought in to scoop up these properties and quote, rescue them?
I think it's a good thing when cities strategically tap the private sector to do things and to keep assets open to the public. When the private sector can...
Once the private sector has a park, I mean, in the case of the park in Benton Harbor, the private sector took that park and, you know, multimillionaire family and business and took that park and said, okay, now in order to get on here, you got to pay a couple $100 a year to be a member of our country club.
Well, I could also throw out many of the number of examples of public parks that were turned over to nonprofits and community associations to run, to keep open and to keep healthy. A big example of that would be Central Park in New York City that everybody's familiar with, which was essentially run into the ground under the city's operation, but it's become a thriving asset under a nonprofit conservancy management approach. So I think,
but that's not what I'm talking about. That's not real privatization. That, you know, nonprofit
that,
is,
that if you're,
is
if you're defined,
nonprofits are government subsidized.
If you're trying to define privatization as only being a situation in which billionaire corporations come into play or other types of boogeymen, then I think you're fundamentally misreading the full scope of what the private sector is doing out there.
Why should the private sector play any role at all in having, managing, or owning parks or libraries or police departments, fire departments, prisons, water systems, septic systems? These are things that are natural monopolies. Why should any community give these things over to corporations and billionaires for any reason? Why?
Well, one of the main reasons that you see cities and states and every level of government doing this is because the private sector has shown over decades of experience, sometimes even centuries of experience, that they can actually run these things. And they can do them at a lower cost and at a higher quality of service.
Now, Yosemite has been doing fine. We've got parks all over the United States that have been well managed. It seems that, you know, absent that, what you're saying is true when you have Republicans in charge who cut the funding to these kind of programs or make it impossible to raise taxes on rich people to pay for these kind of programs. But historically, America has not done that. Historically, America has done very well taking care of her parks and her libraries.
Well, actually, that's fundamentally wrong. I mean, just on the issue of parks themselves, many, many parks out there are being strapped as cities and states and other levels of government are pouring funds into,
No, I get it. You know, for the last 32 years, you're absolutely right. I mean, ever since Reaganomics started and the destruction of the American middle class began and this massive transfer of wealth from working people to very, very wealthy people began, things were, you know, our parks were fine in the 60s. I can tell you I was there. But they're certainly not now. I agree with you.
Well, Tom, I can tell you that, first of all, you framed this as being some sort of, you know, right-wing or conservative type of thing.
I think it is.
But I think you're wrong. I mean, if you actually look at the actual experience out there, you have policymakers of every possible political stripe in this country and around the world at every level of government. People like Ed Rendell in Pennsylvania, who was former mayor of Philadelphia, former governor.
So you find a few sellout Democrats. These are not progressives, and these are not people who are, at least with regard to that policy.
Well, but you framed it as a political issue. You framed it as a
I framed it as a libertarian issue.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think if you look out there, you will see sensible policymakers of all political stripes, Republicans, Democrats, and, you know, everywhere on the spectrum in between, that will realize that there can be major efficiencies to be gained, that they can free up resources for other uses in the public sector.
Okay, got it. Glenn, we're out of time. Glenn Gilroy, hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Glenn Gilroy, Director of Government Reform at the Reason Foundation. Reason.org is the website. Thank you, Glenn.
All right, thank you, Tom.
I mean, you win a lot of cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. Very, very interesting, this whole issue of privatization and what it brings up. I find it just horrifying that the city of Detroit is selling off the art collection at the Detroit Art Institute. And that, and I thought it was very interesting timing that last week NPR chose to do a very, very nice fluff piece on how Andrew Carnegie, one of the robber barons of the robber baron era, the Gilded Age, one of the guys who was responsible for one of the most one of the greatest atrocities in the history of labor, killing employees, funded in his later days, his philanthropic days, funded several thousand libraries across the United States, or over 1,000 libraries across the United States. And NPR just did this whole, oh, isn't this wonderful kind of piece on it. And I thought, where's that coming from? And then, you know, it hit me, of course. You know, it's like the Reason Foundation or somebody like that called him up and said, hey, why don't you do a piece about how wonderful it is that billionaires help people out, you know, help communities out. We all should, you know, find our own billionaires. Billionaires are good, don't you know? Here's my take on what is going on, and then we'll pick up yours, on what is going on with everything from what's going on in Detroit to what's going on with the Washington Post being sold. Just to lay it out. Before Reagan's massive tax cut on billionaires, we basically didn't have billionaires in the United States. I mean, there were a few people who were pushing that in terms of income, but the mind-boggling riches that existed in the United States, by and large, were left over from the Gilded Age. They were the hereditary fortunes of the Carnegies and the Fords and the Rockefellers and the Mellons and the Skate and the Dow and all this kind of stuff. And from the 1930s until the 1980s, there were very few sudden emergences of massive amounts of wealth. Why? Because, well, if you took over $3 million a year out of your business, the government started taxing you at 70% after that. And so people would say, I'll take the first $3 million, but after that, nah, I'll keep the money in the company and pay my employees well. And so we had a 50-year period of incredible growth of the middle class in the United States, the strongest middle class the world had ever seen at that time. I mean, you could say that now about Sweden or Finland or Denmark or Norway or Germany or France, but you can't say that about the United States anymore. But when Reagan cut the top tax rate and changed the rules for executive compensation so executives could be compensated with stock options in addition to money, which allowed executives to pull out, as Dollar Bill McGuire did from United Healthcare, $1.7 billion, as Stephen J. Hemsley has done so far from United Healthcare, over $1 billion, which allowed CEOs and company founders to become billionaires in fairly short order. When Reagan changed the rules of the game to make that happen, what happened was we had this emergence, this new billionaire class in the United States. And, of course, on the other end of the spectrum, you had the emergence of the new working poor, because super rich always comes with super poor. So we have more and more people today working part-time jobs, a radical increase in the number of people working part-time jobs, a radical increase in the number of families where more than one person is working to support the family. We now not only have two-wage earner families, but we have 2, 3, 4, 5 job families among those two people. And in some cases, we have 3 and 4 wage earners in a family where the kids are working too, and they're living at home with their parents and helping to pay the mortgage. All so that the billionaire class can make more money because, you know, hey, it all flows to the top. Reagan said a rising tide lifts all boats, but that's only true for yacht owners. So, you know, he's got a rising tide going, and the top 1% are doing just fine, thank you very much. But everybody else, not so much. So this is the world that we have. And so you have people like Jeff Bezos, or Bezos, or however you say his name, who, you know, are just mind-bogglingly rich. Now, he's a smart businessman. He had a great idea, and he built a great company. I might disagree with some of their business practices, but I don't think you can do any, I don't think you can characterize it as anything other than all those things that I just said. Now, it violates the standards of antitrust protections that we had in place up until the time of Reagan. That was the other thing that Ronald Reagan contributed to this, was in 1982 he stopped prosecuting companies and individuals under the Sherman Antitrust Act. And so you have these giant behemoth companies like Walmart and Amazon and others that basically have pushed all the competition out of the marketplace. Would not have been allowed before 1980. In fact, AT&T had just been broken up before Reagan came into office. And when it was broken up, it actually helped the stockholders. So now, you know, the rest of us get to sit around and watch the billionaires play. Oh, I think I'll buy a newspaper. I think I'll buy a city park. I think I'll buy the Detroit Art Institute's collection. This is not the American dream. This is not the America that people fought and died to build over the last 200 plus years over and over and over again. This is not the America that cares about community, that cares about, you know, fundamental family values. This is the America, the dystopian America that Ayn Rand and her objectivist followers and the libertarians who lever off her philosophy think would be a good place to live. You've heard them come on this program over and over again and say the best time in the history of America was the robber baron era, the Gilded Age. Well, that was the best time for the billionaires. It was one of the worst times in American history for working people. They were being shot, slapped, punched, and knocked 16 ways to Sunday. We had some of the worst poverty in the history of the United States during the Gilded Age among working people. And that's the direction we're going. And so these things with Benton Harbor and Detroit, these are symptoms of this larger problem that all goes back to Reagan.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And until somebody has the political courage to stand up and repute Reaganomics, it's going to continue to get worse. So is Liz Cheney going to go to jail? She could be facing a $1,000 fine, actually. It looks like she's got a fishing license in Wyoming that you can only get if you swear that you've lived there 10 years. She says she doesn't know how it happened. I mean, you know, she went down and applied for it, but that a clerk must have made a mistake and given her the fishing license rather than the 1 year. You got to live there for a year to get any fishing license at all, and the special one, you got to live there 10 years. And she applied for it 3 months after she moved back to the state. She's thinking now of running for elective office in Wyoming. So the fishing license was probably necessary for the, you know, to shoot the video of her fly fishing in the streams that will be part of the campaign videos. So anyhow, they're investigating it. As Daily Kos says, you know, if she's busted for this, it'll be the least lethal thing, crime, that any Cheney has recently committed. Stephen in Kingston, Oklahoma. Hey, Stephen, you wanted to talk about privatization?
Tom, how are you doing?
I am very well, thank you. What's up?
You know, this is my first call. I wanted to thank you, first of all, for the excellent reporting that you've done over the years.
Thank
you. I've enjoyed your radio and your TV show.
Thank you.
And I wanted to tell you a little success story about a grassroots group here in Kingston, Oklahoma, which is in the southeastern portion of the state. And it's in regard to the privatization of Lake Texoma State Park.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally planned as a public-private partnership, which we would all be so grateful for, because this was going to be the greatest thing to happen to southeastern Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And it's morphed into the complete liquidation of our state park and into the hands of Aubrey McClendon, one of the largest funders of the Swift Boat Veterans hit piece on John Kerry.
Hmm.
If you remember.
I do remember, Swift, yes.
Veterans.
Yeah.
So I thank you for confronting all the PR spin surrounding privatization, outsourcing, and deregulation, which we've suffered for the last 30 years.
Well, so this Texoma State Park.
Here at Lake
Texoma
State Park.
Yeah,
we have a website. It's called defendlaketexomastatepark.org.
Okay.
If people want to check it out and get more information.
Okay, and that's Lake That's Lake Texoma.
Yes.
Statepark.org.
Statepark.org. If you put a dash between each word, that's our new website.
Uh huh. Okay.
And there's a lot of background information on it. It's a very complicated issue, so comprises the material for an upcoming book that we're going to release.
Cool.
But for now, let it suffice that the Army Corps of Engineers was the sponsor of liquidating this park based on federal legislation that goes back to 1999 that treated it as surplus land.
Wow.
At that time, the park was the most popular and profitable of 51 state parks. Our current governor, Mary Fallon, was a key privatization agent. She was a lieutenant governor under Frank Keating,
right.
Came in, cut the tax rates, and immediately targeted 10 state parks for privatization.
Yeah, of course. If the government has anything of value, pass it off to billionaires. And if the government does anything of value, figure out a way that some corporation can do it instead, because it's valuable. They've got you, you know, by the short hairs, as it were, and you can't go anywhere else to get water or septic or libraries or parks, unless you're rich enough to have your own library or your own private park or your own estate. So excellent story, Stephen. Thank you for calling and sharing it with us. Mike in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. Calling you back. I spoke to you last week. I want to talk a little bit about privatization. Your guest said something to the effect of companies have been proving for centuries, and he did say that, that these corporations have proven that not only can they handle the logistics of public goods, but they trump municipal and state governments. There's not one instance, not one, dating back to the early days of the Industrial Revolution in Britain and France, in which private companies took the lead, excuse me again, Tom, I got a bit of a cold, took the lead on providing any of these public goods. As a matter of fact, in the early days of fire service in the United States, you would subscribe to a certain fire company, you would put that emblem on your house, and if your house was on fire, when they showed up, if you didn't have the right emblem on there, your house burnt to the ground.
That's right.
I don't know if it were you or another progressive talker who was explaining the lineage of the London fog coat, but it was right on
the
money.
It was not me. It's not me.
Okay. During Industrial Revolution Britain, the air was so polluted that it was covered with a soot of pollution in a constant fashion.
Right.
And the term London fog coat derived from businessmen and other people with money wearing these coats to keep the soot of the city off of them. During the periods of industrializing France, sewers, now think of this, sewers were such a mind-bending technology at the time that people were actually taking tours of them on paddle boats throughout the sewers of Paris.
Wow.
The disease rate in the streets of, you know, I always find this to kind of digress a little bit about how we sort of, my mother at Christmas time always puts up these little knickknacks of the Dickens village, and I don't think she's ever read any Dickens, because if she did, I don't think that she would put up all of these little villages that depict sort of this rosy soliloquy of Christmas, when in fact, times were so desolate and so bad for people in Europe and much in the United States. And you were speaking much about how bad it was for working men and women in the United States. I mean, it is history that when you stood up to these folks and to the billionaire class or to the oligarch, and there are instances in the United States where these people were mowed down by machine gun fire, not only by
the Ludlow Massacre.
The Ludlow Massacre, yeah. You know, women and children hiding under tents as the military and police came through and mowed these people to pieces with machine guns. In terms of libertarianism, and I told your caller this, I often joke that they're Republican potheads, and we're almost there. You know, there's no reason to throw the baby out with the bathwater over marijuana.
Yeah.
And I really believe that these folks have come to the conclusion that if they allow the oligarch to run wild and rampant, that they'll be able to smoke weed or whatever it is that they want to do in their own personal behavior. And I think we have locomoted to...
I'm totally with you. And my old friend Mike Dirks used to say libertarians are just Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid, because they're in favor of legalizing prostitution as well. Mike, I have to move along, but excellent points all. Thank you very much for the call. Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick.
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
What was the name of that joker you were talking to at the beginning of the show about privatization of...
Len Gilroy with Reason. But let's not pick on him. He's not here to defend himself.
Well, okay. Well, to my way of thinking, the American taxpayers paid for the libraries. American taxpayers, Carnegie initially started some. I figured he knew if he didn't do some right, he might be going to hell or something.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is the public taxpayers pay for the maintenance, upkeep, and purchase of new books, just like the road system.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if they're privatized, do you think the government's going to return the money to the taxpayers? Of course not. Here in West Virginia and neighboring state Ohio and PA, they privatized some publicly owned roads and turned them into toll roads. And in all cases, they're in worse shape now than they ever were.
Sure.
This idea of privatizing everything is crazy. This is not the America I grew up in. It's not the America you grew up in. I believe we're about the same age. Where I lived in Maryland, once a week, my mom got us kids together. We drove 4 miles to a place called Seabrook, Maryland. We met a bus the size of a Greyhound bus. It was a library on wheels.
Hmm.
And that's how it was done.
Yeah.
They want to privatize their schools. They want to they've already privatized the military. They privatized the NSA. And you know something? If people don't wake up, smell the coffee, and take some interest of what's going on in this country, one day we're going to wake up and, we're going to be living in a feudal system.
Yes. Well, increasingly we are, Rick. You're absolutely right. And feudalism is libertarianism. It is the direction that they're heading that we're heading. And, there are a few people in public office who will say that out loud. Bernie Sanders is probably the one that the people who are familiar with this show are most familiar with. But we need a president to say that. And it's not going to happen until enough people start saying that. And that's not going to happen until, the media starts talking about it. Rick, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Well said. John in McKenna, Illinois, 1 minute before the break. John, it's yours.
Hi, Tom. I was just going to point out that when the commons are being seized for privatization without any input from the people who own those commons in common, then it's exactly the mirror image of what the right decries as nationalization when it's going the other way.
Oh, when as happened to Ayn Rand's father's drugstore, when the communists seized it and nationalized it. You're right.
Exactly so.
You're right. It's the mirror image of that. And it should be, equally, it should be engaged in with an equal level of scrutiny here in the United States anyway. I mean, I can't speak for Soviet Russia in 1999 or 1918, but when we nationalize things, when we use eminent domain, there's a long and relatively thoughtful process that is involved in that, and the same should be involved for privatization. Excellent point, John. Excellent point. Thank you very much. Thanks for calling and thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be right back 15 minutes before the hour here on the topic.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And let me add, by the way, as they privatize these things in Michigan, the money is not going to the people. It's going to the banksters who hold the bonds. This is just to pay off banks. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's incredible, this whole privatization thing. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Listening to WWRL, you wanted to chime in on this.
Yeah, the point I wanted to make about privatization is the fact that nationwide privatization is going on much more extensively than most people realize even. For instance, with respect to Medicaid, quietly under the radar screen in various states, like even in politically blue Democratic-leaning states like New York, there have been attempts to privatize Medicaid going on, which have been successful with both little attention and little public outcry. And there was even a May 1st New York Times article on the subject by Nina Bernstein about how Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo, through the State Department of Health, is moving literally tens of thousands of Medicaid beneficiaries who need long-term medical care into managed care plans.
Right.
And this mirrors very much what's going on in Florida with that awful governor down there, Rick Scott.
Yep.
And the problem with these HMOs is they make their money and they save money by denying care and treatment.
Yep.
This is the reason why when Charlie Crist was governor, he threatened to veto any legislation that came through to privatize Medicaid in his state. And he was successful when he was governor. After he left, of course, Rick Scott became governor. And Rick Scott has no problem with privatizing Medicaid. And unfortunately, too many Democrats are drinking the Republican Kool-Aid and going along with it.
I agree with you, Jerry. And that speaks to the power of these billionaires, the lobbying power, and the desperate straits that many elected officials find themselves in, where if they want to win an election, they have to have money. And to get that money, where do you go? I mean, it's the old Willie Sutton story. You know, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. Well, why do you take contributions from billionaires or from Wall Street? Because that's where the money is, and or from the health industry or whatever it may be. And you're right. This is not a totally partisan issue. Jerry, thank you for the call. Although the Republicans have this as a religion, the Democrats have it as a, oh, I hate to do it, but Robert in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind?
Well, you know, this whole thing about liberal and conservative, but what I find out is any system, I don't care whether it's right wing, left wing, or whatever wing it is, number one, if you don't have a middle class, your country is gone.
Yeah.
Number one, either capitalism or communism, if you put too much power in the hands of a few, then the system is going to collapse.
You are absolutely right.
Far right capitalism or your far right, you're a dead set socialist.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. People need to stop thinking in terms of socialism and capitalism, but where is the power going?
Yeah. And money in this culture and this society is power. So, you know, ultimately it becomes where is the money going as well. Excellent point, Robert. Thank you for calling and making it. Fetcher in Bristol, New Hampshire. Hey, Fetcher.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Good. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I see you don't have your sling.
No, I don't. I wore it part of the day. I'm wearing it sometimes. So I think I'm getting better. Hopefully.
Super.
Knock wood.
I don't know if these people we've had on are brilliant, as usual. How am I going to qualify myself? The unreasonable dark side of reality, maybe. I wanted to... Oh, I can't hear you, Tom.
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It was a suggestion for the plate. Maybe it's privatizing people's lives and death, but where I live in New Hampshire, it's live free or die.
Right.
And it's kind of like... I don't know if I'm saying this right. My way or the highway.
Mm-hmm.
During a revolution, maybe we are having one, but I don't see the real signs. Well, we're pretty well established here. But
yeah,
hopefully it's clear understanding what's going on. But why not have a plate that says, live free to never die? So once you live free, you'll be like Shakespeare. You'll always be alive.
Yeah. Or just live free. Has that? I used to live in New Hampshire, and I always thought it was ironic that the license plates that say "Live Free or Die" are made, or at least used to be made, in the prisons. That's got to be a really tough job. But excellent one, Fetcher. Thank you for the call. Thanks for watching, Barbara in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hey, Barbara, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You mentioned a lot about Ronald Reagan and Reaganomics.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just because that's the beginning of all of our big mess here, or?
By and large. Jimmy Carter drank a little of the Kool-Aid in the last 2 years of his administration when he deregulated the trucking and air industries following. You know, Maggie Thatcher was elected in 78, and she immediately destroyed the coal miners union, and just, you know, she was way ahead of Reagan. And Carter drank a little of that Kool-Aid, but that was nothing compared to what Reagan did.
Well, don't you at the same time need to be pointing out all the present-day Reagan supporters, I mean the key persons, and that we, they're alive now, so.
Many of them, yeah.
Yeah,
and they still worship him like a god. And, you know, 32 years of Reaganomics, you can't say it often enough, 32 years of Reaganomics has hollowed out the American middle class and the American economy and left us fragile and destroyed. So, and yes, the people who supported him and the people who continue to support him in op-eds and you know, political speeches and whatnot are equally to blame. Barbara, thank you for the call. Well said. Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Hey, Sam, how you doing?
Oh, pretty good, Brother Tom.
Hey, Sam.
I call you Professor Hartman today.
Thank you. We have just a minute left for the hour, Sam. What's on your mind?
I think we should go clear back to Enron and start doing another investigation of all them cases where money was stolen or cheated and took where it wasn't supposed to be took and in the Reagan years and bring it all the way up through to this year,
yeah.
2013.
Yeah.
Just review them all.
Start with the history of Goldman Sachs, and there's just a whole bunch of it. Yeah. By the way, you asked Danielle, how's Higgins, our cat? Higgins is, I'm not sure, he's not doing so well. He's not eating and he's getting skinny and he's just, Louise took him back to the vet earlier this week, but I think he's getting old, Sam. So anyhow, thanks a lot for the call, Sam. Nice to hear from you and thanks for watching us there in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. 6 seconds. Okay, not enough time to put another caller on. Carson, Larry, Gabriel, stick around. We'll get to you in after the hour, after the break. It is 2 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman program, a minute and a half thereabouts. And we will be back with Tanya Marchio, the president of Team Investments. We're going to talk about this whole concept that is starting to take some traction in California about using eminent domain, the Fifth Amendment, to save homeowners.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Last week we talked about a program that is being experimented with or contemplated, actually, by a city in California. Several other cities had similarly thought about it, and in each case, banksters came into the cities and ran campaign ads or poured money into city council races and things like that to basically blow up the deal. But as we know from the Keogh decision before the Supreme Court, back when David Souter was so vilified, the Supreme Court has said that a community can seize private property even for a private for-profit interest if, at the end of the day, that works out best for the community or for the city. And so what this town was, Richmond, California, that's right, what Richmond, California was thinking of doing was saying, okay, somebody owes $400,000 on a home that's underwater. It's worth $300,000. We will go to the bank and say, you know, we'll give you $300,000 for it, which is more than they get at a short sale, by the way. And banks actually make money. If a bank has a $400,000 mortgage and they short sell it for $250,000, they make more than $400,000 back between the money they get from the FDIC, the tax write-offs they can take, and the forward debts that they put back on the homeowner after they've shown a profit. Typically, banks make anywhere from 10 to 35% on a short sale, even though it looks like they're losing money. So the banks would not be able to make that profit under this deal. Instead, the town simply comes in and says, okay, you know, here's what we're going to give you. This is what it's worth. And the bank has to take that. They write off the debt. And then the homeowner is offered the home for $300,000, which is what it's worth, minus 20% for the cost of doing the whole deal. And it's actually being done by a private company that's working with the city. And they get a 30-year mortgage and lowered interest payments. And this, you know, lets money that otherwise would have been going to mortgage payments to banksters start going back into the community. So it seemed like a good idea to me. But Tanya Marchio, thinks it's not a good idea. She is the founder and president of Team Investments. TeamInvestmentsInc.com is the website. Tanya, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me. Love being with you.
Thank you. Explain to me why this is, to use your description, the worst idea in the world.
That is just about exactly what I said. So first and foremost, you have to realize what eminent domain was made for. It was made to take property that was going to go for a park or a road or something to that degree. This is not true eminent domain, but they've made it sound good. So I'll give them the fact that they've made it sound good. Now, let's think about where that money comes from. First, it's going to come from the taxpayers. It's a horrible idea because California is already broke and doesn't have the money to do this. Then you have to think about...
No, there's no money coming from the taxpayers.
Really? So who do you think is going to pay for that home?
When the homeowner refinances the home,
they
write a $300,000 check to the government to buy the home back.
Okay, because these people can't pay $1,500 a month, so now we're going to ask them to write a $300,000 check.
No, we're going to ask them to pay $1,000 a month instead of $1,500 a month.
Right, and who do you think is financing that?
Some bank.
Okay.
So there's no shortage of banks that would love to loan homeowners money at 4%.
Except for now we've just squashed every horrible FHA loan. FHA loan, you only have to have a 580 and put 3.5% down. Now we're going to lend money to people who haven't paid their mortgage in probably 4+ years.
No, this is only for people who are making their payments on mortgages on houses that are so hopelessly underwater
that is not true. This is eminent domain for any foreclosed property. How about this, Tom? Let me give you a better solution. Because this is a horrible idea. Because first and foremost, it is going to be on the backs of the taxpayers because they're going to have to buy it first and then turn around and sell it to the homeowner.
Right.
But let me give you a better solution. San Francisco, according to Kay Schiller, if you believe those numbers, appreciated 26% over the past year. This is a city close to San Francisco. That means that there is a demand for this type of property. How about we let the banks, and I am not a bank advocate, and you know that, but how about we let the banks short sell this property to someone who wants to buy it, albeit probably an investor, and then rent it back to these people so that they can afford this property and now free enterprise is taken over instead of doing something completely cockamamie that isn't going to work in the first place?
Well,
how
that
about
is,
we stop pretending
so you're suggesting,
that these things work and let's let free enterprise take over?
Okay. First, to go back to about 3 minutes into your comment, this is what eminent domain is all about, according to the United States Supreme Court. In the Keogh case, what they were looking at was there was public land, privately owned land. It was basically a slum, but it was in an area that was overlooking the ocean, and it was and they went in and they seized it, and then they handed it over to a for-profit developer who turned it into multi-million-dollar condos.
And they made it better. And they made it better for the community.
Yes, and this would make these homes better because these people would no longer be on the edge of default, and it would increase the amount of revenue that's going into the local community rather than to Wall Street banks.
Tom, we need to stop bailing everyone out. There is nothing wrong with somebody making a bad financial decision, albeit because they made a bad financial decision to buy that home when they did. How about
in most cases, though, these people, Tanya, were victims of scam artists in the banking industry.
When do we take responsibility for ourselves?
When do the banks take responsibility? How many banksters have gone to jail, Tanya?
Oh, no. I agree. I am not pro-bank. We know I am not
so
pro-bank.
This is something that doesn't hurt the banks so badly that they go out of business. It merely reduces their profits somewhat, and it allows homeowners to once again get their homes back, to be building the equity, toward their retirement.
This is the way to do it. And if you really want to talk
about
it.
Well, your suggestion to just give the homes to billionaires, to sell the homes cheaply to very real wealthy people and let them be landlords, that's being done.
I am not very wealthy, and I go out and buy a bunch of those houses, and I am not very wealthy. But let's go back to your bank comment for a second. The banks, the Wells Fargos, the Chases, those are all just servicers. And I am anti-bank. I don't like the big banks either. But what servicers do, and this is what has to stop, is this. They prolong a short sale or a foreclosure for so long because they make fees. They're not really the money behind the house. They're just the servicer of that product, right? So they're making all these fees and not short selling these homes or foreclosing on these homes right away because regardless of whether the person is making money or not,
she's on the phone.
not via eminent domain.
Yeah. Okay, we missed your last sentence because your Skype crashed, but I've got you on the phone now, Tanya. So repeat your last sentence.
Sure. Let me turn this down. So the banks are making money servicing these loans.
Yeah, I got
period.
That.
They're not actually the money behind it. So we need to stop the practice of the banks not short selling or foreclosing for months and months and months.
So you want to use big government to force the banks to do the right thing.
I want the banks to do the right thing because we as the taxpayers bailed the banks out. The banks
right.
should be doing the right things, but I do
right.
not.
And you want big government to force them to
the
do
right
that.
Thing.
I'd rather have big government help out the taxpayers. I mean, if we're going to come up with two different big government solutions, I'm on the side of the homeowners, not the banksters.
I'm on the side of the homeowners too, but we bailed out the banks. The banks need to do what's right, and if we need to force
but they're not.
Them to do what's right, that's what I believe. I don't think that we should have to use eminent domain, which was not invented for this purpose, to bail out a homeowner that probably
in principle
can't pay
I agree with you,
anyway.
Tanya.
Let's let them rent.
In
There's
principle, no,
rent.
I don't agree with that. But in principle, I agree with you that the banksters caused this problem. That the banksters have not paid the cost of this. That they ripped us off, all of us. And they should be paying the fight. But the bottom line is that the banksters have so much power, so much political and economic power, that they're never going to do that.
I agree with you on that.
And that's the tragedy. Anyhow,
we always end up agreeing at the end.
Okay. Tanya Marchio, founder and president of Team Investments, teaminvestmentsinc.com. Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. We will be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do we get people out of the clutches of criminal, and I say that very advisedly, criminal banksters? Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. But don't let Limbaugh know, he'll want some. Does not, however, lead to stiff thinking. That's terrible, terrible fun. Limbaugh, in fact, yesterday apparently played a clip of me on CNN over the weekend on his show. It's like, oh, man, am I? It's like, well, enough said, I guess. Robin in Seattle. Hey, Robin, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Thanks for having me on. I've been a longtime listener and fascinated by what you're saying.
Thank you for listening to KBCS. What's up?
Oh, thank you. So, you know, I'm really interested in your idea on kind of getting back at the banksters who trick these people into these loans, you know, got them into houses they couldn't afford, and then, you know, the people go into foreclosure and they take a huge loss, and, you know, maybe we should spin it around so the bank takes that loss or, you know, trims their profit a little bit. Wouldn't really cost them much, and it would kind of
well, that's what
we're doing wrong.
That's what this program that Richmond is talking about would do, is it would cause the banks to actually, it would just be a wash for the banks. And the banks are fighting this really, really hard because they make money on foreclosures. They foreclose a $400,000 mortgage, they make $500,000. And plus on top of that, the longer they can string it out, as Tanya correctly pointed out, the more they can make in fees. They can extract $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 in fees out of a mortgage that size.
It's so unbelievable. So I had an idea. You know, in Seattle, we have kind of the real estate's come back very strong, and mm-hmm. and prices are way up back where they were. So I'd say, what if we went back and said any loan from 2004 to 2008, you know, the bank would suffer the loss if the house went under, but if the house sold at a profit, the bank would take that money. So, you know, you have the poor people that lost were tricked, but the rich people or the ones that sell at a gain, which you'd normally think of as smart because they bought low and sold high, we take the money back and give it back to the banks too, because they probably got tricked into those loans as well.
Well, what we saw as a consequence of the Great Bush crash was over $10 trillion, if my memory serves me right, in actual equity in the United States, principally held by the middle class, basically vanish overnight. And several trillion dollars of that equity show up on the balance sheets of the banksters and the billionaires. And until that wrong has been righted, I don't think that the American middle class is going to be all that excited. That's about doing anything. And that's one of the reasons why I think the President Obama's speech in Phoenix today is probably going to be met with, you know, kind of a shrug of the shoulders. People don't understand what has happened with banking. You know, saying that you're going to shut down Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you know, nice idea. But this is very, very complex stuff. The banksters have made it so complex to confuse people and make it hard for people to figure out what's going on. And they're still committing their crimes. I mean, every single day they're still committing crimes. Robin, thank you. And they will continue to do it until somebody puts them in jail. Carson in Orange, California. Hey, Carson, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Man, you're doing great. The interviews have been awesome.
Thank you.
Hey, I was, I'm in California. You don't come on till like 12 o'clock. So I choked down some conservative radio before I started listening to your show. And I get really bent out of shape when I start hearing these conservatives, you know, on the issue of like health care, talking so much about their money and their personal property. And I want to go on the offensive and start calling them. And I want to ask them, how much would they pay as an individual for everybody in America to have free health care? And I just wanted to ask you about that question in general before I went out there and kind of went in no man's land.
Yeah. I'm not sure I understand the question. Are you going to call a conservative radio show and ask a conservative host how much they would contribute so other people could have health care? Their answer would be nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And my answer personally would be literally, without hesitation, an arm and a leg. I would, if everybody would put each other's health.
But the reality is in the middle, Carson. If you look at countries where they have national health care programs, single-payer health care programs, the cost is about half of what our health care program is because there's no price gouging going on, which is the biggest problem that we have in our health care program. And everybody gets covered. And, yeah, people pay for it through their taxes, but the rich pay more taxes, so they pay more for it. But, you know, that's life. I mean, that's a system that actually works. I'm haunted by this German businessman who was interviewed on Bloomberg International out of Europe. And the reporter, the person interviewing him, was an American. And he said, and this is a very wealthy businessman, a multimillionaire. And he said, what's your tax rate? How much you pay in taxes? And the guy said, I think I pay about 56% in taxes. And the guy was just horrified interviewing. He was like horrified. He's like, how can you stand that? Why don't you move out of Germany? And the guy was like, it's fine. I like living here. And this question came back around again about 3 minutes later. And finally, the third time that this reporter asked this German businessman, this wealthy businessman, this question, how can you stand paying 56% income tax? The guy said, I don't want to be a rich man in a poor country. I am perfectly willing to pay my share to have a modern Germany, with modern high-speed rail and modern solar power and modern hotels and modern infrastructure and a modern healthcare system. He says, I'm perfectly willing to pay for that. It benefits my life, too. And that's the point that I think we may need to make. And that I think, is the big healthcare debate with conservatives, is if you think that somehow you're going to benefit by not having to pay into a national healthcare system so your taxes are lower and you don't care about the fact that the guy sitting next to you on the park bench or on the airplane or in the movie theater doesn't have health insurance, wait until that guy sitting next to you, like one-tenth of the population of India, has tuberculosis and he coughs and you get it. And now you've got a serious problem, particularly if that tuberculosis goes beyond your lungs and gets into your bones or your brain, where it can be a fatal disease, even when treated. And so it really is a public health issue. If everybody isn't well, then everybody is at risk, even the people who are well and who do have health insurance. If everybody is not covered, if everybody doesn't have health insurance, this is why Obamacare has such an emphasis on free preventative care, that everybody has free preventative care. And it's a really important thing. So, Carson, I hope those are a few talking points that you can use. Thanks a lot for calling and for listening. 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. The president speaking on Fannie Mae. Is he speaking now? He's speaking as we speak. I'll share some of what he's saying with you right after the break, and then we'll continue to pick up your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
After all, anything goes summer. We'll be right back. Program. Okay, the president's proposal in a nutshell. Pardon? Oh, you just finished, yeah. The president's proposal, in a nutshell, is that we shut down Fannie and Freddie, which basically backstop banks. So when they make mortgages, you know, they reduce the risk for banks to make mortgages, and provides a little extra money for them to make more mortgages. It expands the potential of banks to participate in the mortgage market, and replace it with a new agency that is has a much more limited role, and doesn't actually, if my understanding is correct, doesn't actually hold the paper, but acts more as a guarantor, only after all private options are exhausted in the event of a mortgage collapse or failure, an individual mortgage collapse or failure, something that would have less systemic risk. I think, you know, shutting down Fannie and Freddie is something that should appeal to conservatives. They've been, you know, they've been trying to blame the housing crash on Fannie and Freddie forever. It had, you know, Fannie and Freddie had nothing to do with it. But the semi-privatization of Fannie and Freddie under Republican administrations has resulted in Fannie and Freddie not always being good actors, because they're three quarters banksters, one quarter government, which is a really, really bad combination. So I think that the president has come up with a reasonably good proposal, which means it doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell. Republicans, as you know, committed to each other back on the night that President Obama was inaugurated into office in January 20th of 2009. They committed to each other at that top secret meeting at the caucus room restaurant that Newt Gingrich, you know, told us about here on this program on the air. Robert Draper wrote a book about, "That's Not What Good We Do." They committed to each other to do everything they could to obstruct his presidency and make sure that he was viewed by history as a failure. In fact, Jeb Hensarling said that the Republican Party was going to become the Taliban. Kevin McCarthy said we have to stop every single piece of legislation. These guys were quite blunt about it. And Newt on my program bragged about it. So you really think that the Republicans in Congress are going to let the president have any kind of victory at all? Particularly when Mitch McConnell, a guy who's leading the Republicans in the Senate, is up for re-election in Kentucky next year, and he's facing a primary from a right-winger? I mean, all the president has to do to take out McConnell is say, "Thank you so much, Mitch, for compromising and making a deal with me." That will be the political death of him. And he knows it. So, and, you know, Mitch McConnell's very hopeful that he can become, that he can have Harry Reid's seat, that he can be the Senate Majority Leader, that the Republicans will take the Senate in 2014. I'm somewhat skeptical, but hey, never underestimate the power of billions and billions of dollars. So we'll see how this all shakes out. But right now, the president, he's got, you know, what's the old saying? When you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. Bob Dylan, I recall. As I recall. And, you know, the president right now, he's got nothing to lose. I mean, he's out there. Every speech he's giving is saying, here's some good, solid proposals that historically have been supported by Republicans and conservatives, as well as liberals and progressives and Democrats. And so, but because they came out of his mouth, Mitch McConnell has, you know, he's got to say stop. You know, at that meeting at the caucus room restaurant, you had this whole wide variety of people, but I think perhaps most importantly, the guy who's really running the train now for the Republican Party, even though he's not in the Republican Party anymore, or he is part of the party, but he's not an elected official anymore, is Jim DeMint. He left his seat early to take a $2 million a year job running the Heritage Foundation. And as I recall, it was $2 million. I might be wrong on that. Maybe it's only $1 million, but whatever it is. Jim DeMint is the guy who is, become the tail is wagging the Republican dog in the Senate anyway. But you had Paul Ryan at that meeting. You know, the vice presidential candidate last time around on the Republican side. You had Eric Cantor, the number two man in the House of Representatives. You had Kevin McCarthy, who's the number three guy in the House of Representatives on the Republican side. You had, like, senior, powerful members, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren. And on the Senate side, you had John Kyle, Tom Coburn, Dr. No, the guy who's responsible for so many of these filibusters. They call him Dr. No. He's a physician, gynecologist, I believe. John Ensign and Bob Corker. And, of course, Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich. So, surprise. Bill in Laurel, Montana. Hey, Bill, you want to talk about the banksters?
Yeah, Tom, I do. And it's glad to see the southpaws getting better.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Well, Tom, I just wanted to comment to the young lady about the ED and the property and stuff. I spoke to you early last year, and we were in the middle of a foreclosure due to a medical problem. But I just wanted to remind her that the banksters have foreclosure insurance. So until they foreclosed on my home and we lost the home, after I petitioned them to give me a financial amnesty on the principal, by then they foreclosed. Then they remarketed the house for about the sum of what I petitioned them to give me a principal reduction on.
Right.
So, but won't do it until they foreclose because they cash in an insurance policy for their loss. And until you get rid of that, which I don't see any way Mr. President can do this,
Yeah. You're
not going to win against the banksters on it.
Yeah, and not only do they have insurance, but they also have the FDIC backing them up, which is one of the ways that they make a profit on these things. And then you got the IRS and everything else. Bill, excellent point. Thank you for calling and making it. Larry in Las Vegas. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
It was Chris Christopherson that wrote the Freedom's Just Another
That's
Word.
Right.
Nothing Left to Lose.
Bobby McGee.
And Janis Joplin made it famous.
Yep. Thank you.
What I wanted to throw at you was, you remember the programs that Stalin had in Ukraine in the 1930s?
I don't remember them, but I know of them.
Well, it starved about 5 million, lots of women and children. He said if you didn't give the food up to the government that you would get nothing. And I kind of see that happening with Archer Daniel Midland and Monsanto and all the way that they're like Pac-Man just gobbling up acres and acres of farmland from the Mall and Paul Kettle type farms and creating their GMO food. But Funny thing is, they're killing them a backward way. They're killing them with these processed foods.
Because
If anyone checks, colon cancer, cancers of the esophagus, cancer's on the rise. Even though we poured billions and billions and billions at it, it's on the rise. And most, there's a few that they've made inroads in, but generally, and as a whole, it's on the rise.
Yep.
Because there's no nutrition in the GMO foods.
And not just the GMO foods.
Soil of nutrients.
Yeah, not just the GMO foods. If you go to conversationswithgreatminds.com, our half-hour interview last Friday was with a fellow by the name of Moss, who wrote a book called Sugar, Salt, Fat, as I recall. And it's about the processed food industry and how they just overwhelm your taste buds with sugar, salt, and fat so that you don't taste how bad the stuff is that they're shoveling at you. And the net result is that they can sell very, very cheap food and for a very, very good price. And you and I, people who eat it anyway, end up, dying. I mean, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, all these things that come along with that. So I would add that to your point. But a point well made, Larry. Thank you for the call. Jerry in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Jerry. Third world country?
Oh, yes, Tom. I think America's becoming a third world country. I've been a social worker since 1965, and what I'm up against is our community, like all of America, is overrun with a new class of people, people with zero money. I grew up in classless America, and here we find homeless people. That's a class, and they're just criminalized and driven away from campsites all around where I live here in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure I read about it in California and other places. I know it's a terrible problem.
Yeah, it's true.
There's
all over the country.
Nobody responsible for dealing with that problem. I wish there was, but there's. Yeah. I think somebody in government has got to be responsible for shelter.
Mm-hmm. The last president to seriously take this on was Lyndon Johnson. And since then, you had George Herbert Walker Bush with his 1,000 Points of Light program saying, we should turn to those thousands and thousands of private charities out there. Let the billionaires and the churches take care of everybody. You had Reagan basically say, screw them all. It's not my job to worry about the poor. The welfare queens and the Cadillacs will figure out, you know, they're doing just fine, thank you very much, according to Reagan. And we have not had a president or an administration or a Congress take serious poverty. In fact, it's very easy to kick the poor people. It's why Bill Clinton ended welfare as we know it, in quotes. He had the political power to do that, or the ability to do that, because so few people are concerned about poverty. But increasingly, as working class people become poor, working class people who used to have some political power, who used to be active, who vote, you're starting to see the Democratic Party in particular wake up to the fact that there is a power base here. On the Republican side, actually, you have Republicans who are slipping into poverty, and they tune into Fox News, and Fox News says it's not the billionaires who are doing this to you, it's not the banksters, it's government. And go join the Tea Party, you know, Dick Armey will have a $600,000 bus come down, pick you up, and drive you down to the National Mall, and you can walk around a funny hat. But it's, you know, people are waking up, is the bottom line, Jerry, and I think that that's a good thing. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Jeb Henseling. Pete Hoekstra, excuse me. We've got to use a Taliban mentality. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat. .com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. Ellen Ratner is on the line with us. Hey,
well,
Ellen.
Thank you very much. The president gave his speech today, accompanied by Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Sean Donovan. And before he gave his speech, the gaggle, which took place on Air Force One, that's when the press secretary actually talks to the press. They said that the problem with what happened in Phoenix, which is where he gave his speech, is that the housing prices fell, investors came in, scooped up the distressed property, and now selling them for profit or renting them at a higher price, which has made it very, very difficult to get decent housing in parts of Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
Then the all other thing is that they said that they, and the president talked about wanting to accelerate housing recovery and to do whatever they can to do that. He talked about perhaps, didn't quite say closing Fannie and Freddie, but it was pretty clear that he wants to do that. And they said they don't want to repeat the mistakes of Fannie and Freddie Mac. At least that is what happened, what he said before the speech. It's as if they're sort of blaming Fannie and Freddie for the entire collapse, when you and I know, as you would say, the banksters had a lot more to do with it.
Yeah, the banksters and deregulation. And that was what the commission that George Bush put together to find out what happened. You know, that financial crisis inquiry commission, they
right.
determined that it was the banksters and deregulation.
Absolutely, and so to just put it on Fannie and Freddie alone is, in my view, and I'm sure your view,
yeah.
to not look at the problem.
Yeah.
It was also interesting, they were asking Jay Carney about the president's electronics, and he said, you're opening the possibility the president has a Kindle, and Jay Carney said, I think I mentioned the other day, I'm on my second Kindle. I also have an iPhone and a MacBook Air. And one of the press people said to him on the plane, it's always about you, isn't it?
Really?
It was really quite astounding.
That's very strange. By the way, is it?
Well, I think that it is as a way to not get direct questions, et cetera.
Oh, yeah. So he's using himself as a shield, basically, to
right.
to divert questions about the president.
Yeah.
That's very graceful and intelligent. And somebody had the audacity to say that he was being an egomaniac.
Right.
I mean, a certain amount of ego comes with that job. But,
of course.
You know. Yeah. That's incredible.
Okay. Looks like the Pentagon is cutting the number of days of furlough from more than 600 for 650,000 civilian workers. the furlough is going to go from 11 to 6. So instead of taking a day off a week for the next 11 weeks, it is going to be just 6 days. Still, you know, hurts people's pocketbooks, but it's not 11 days. Also, the State Department confirmed that the United States and Russian officials are meeting in Washington to discuss Edward Snowden, and the United States is saying they want him back. And that is according to the spokesperson, Jen Psaki.
Right.
Also, today, Center for Disease Control and Prevention said that 19 states and territories saw obesity rates among low-income preschoolers decline from 2008 to 2011. And there are a few, 20 states held steady. The rates increased slightly in 3 states, but the First Lady is taking some credit for that.
Hmm, that's interesting. She has been a good, you know, role model and champion, I suppose, is really the word, for eating well and exercising.
She has. Now, also, interesting, the military is active in Yemen. As you know, we do have people on the ground there, and they are evacuating the embassy in Yemen, and the State Department said that citizens in Yemen, U.S. citizens, should leave the country because our ability to assist U.S. citizens in an emergency remains limited. Also, today, Senator McCain and Senator Graham did meet with Egyptian leaders, and that is different, I guess. They went on what's called a CODEL, and that happened as well. We don't know the outcome of what they talked about. An interesting thing, you know, the Fort Hood alleged shooter, Mr. Hassan, who is in fact a MD psychiatrist.
He's a little more than alleged. He's confessed.
Right. He confessed today, pretty much.
Yeah.
And he said, "I apologize for any mistakes I've made in this endeavor." He is defending himself. No one in recent memory, either in the military or out, can remember of a death penalty person defending themselves.
Yeah, it's almost suicidal. But then keep in mind, this guy thought that by killing a bunch of soldiers, he would cause the president to say, "Whoa, we can't have this. Let's change our Middle Eastern policy and stop going after Al-Qaeda." And that's pretty delusional in and of itself.
Well, I mean, absolutely. And this guy is trained as a psychiatrist.
Yeah. Well, Ellen, you know, my experience has been that people go into particular fields because they think that maybe, you know, they'll get something out of that field.
Right.
So
yeah, I was in mental health for 20 years. I'm a lot less crazy now.
Yeah, there you go. Now that you're out of it. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Do we have time for one or two more or not?
I think we have a little less than a minute.
Ah, okay. So some other interesting things going on today. This is, Bob Ney was on Bill Maher's show with Elliot Spitzer. This is just a sort of interesting little side thing. His madam was apparently arrested by the FBI today for trying to sell prescription drugs.
Right, which just brings up his arrest one more time. It's not... Between that and Anthony Weiner, you know, how's he doing in the polls?
I tell you, I both like Weiner and I like Spitzer. I particularly like Spitzer.
Yeah, I think Spitzer, you know, had this all not gone down, he would have been the next FDR. He would have made a great president of the United States.
I think he's going to make a great controller of New York.
Well, let's hope so. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Have a great afternoon. We will be back. We're going to talk about Bradley Manning.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Yesterday, a senior State Department official was testifying at Bradley Manning's sentencing hearing. And he was talking about, you know, why Manning should be in jail for a long, long, long time. He said that Manning's leak of classified documents to WikiLeaks had, and I quote, "a chilling effect." end quote, on U.S. foreign relations. Gee, you think? Other countries are not happy because we spy on them? I mean, much of the Manning case comes down to one simple fact. The U.S. government, we got caught spying on innocent civilians and diplomats both inside the United States and outside the United States. And now they're going to metaphorically shoot the messenger. I mean, they're not going to shoot Manning, but, you know, send the guy who spilled the beans, Bradley Manning, to jail for years and years and years. Think about that for a second. I mean, isn't this approach that the federal government is taking in the Manning case like a shoplifter saying that his big problem is not that he shoplifted, but that he got caught red-handed? Or like a cheating husband saying that his marital relationship has been harmed because he was caught in bed with another woman? Rather than owning up and saying, yeah, okay, we take responsibility for our actions. Our government is playing a game of pass the blame that's really designed to divert our attention from its own misdeeds. And to make matters worse, the mainstream media in America has fallen hook, line, and sinker for the government's attempt to shift blame from itself onto Bradley Manning. I mean, just think about it. You know, our media is not seriously questioning what the government has been up to. The things that Manning revealed is not discussing the actual context of Manning's document leaks, and they've basically been vilifying him ever since the day he was arrested. Jeremy Scahill was on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, and he had this to say. He laid it out pretty straightforward when he was on Amy Goodman's show.
When those in power want to gin up support for a war, they know who to call in the powerful media outlets. When they want to tamp down any public awareness of an issue, they know how to make it a non-story. And their colleagues in the media have been utterly complicit in this. There has been more coverage of the indictment of that Real Housewives lady and her husband than there has of Bradley Manning. And this is the state of media in this country right now. And it is just devastating that we don't have a media culture that says this trial should have been gavel-to-gavel coverage.
Indeed. So let's, you know, in the spirit of that, let's go back over the details of what the mainstream media has, by and large, missed over the course of the Bradley Manning trial. They've missed the fact that Manning's leaks revealed that U.S. defense contractors were complicit in child trafficking in Afghanistan. Seriously. According to leaked documents, DynCorp, a giant defense contracting firm that makes about $2 billion a year in revenue from you and me, from our taxpayer dollars, threw a party for Afghan security recruits using boys purchased from child traffickers for entertainment. Mainstream media also missed the appalling revelations from the Guantanamo files, which describe how some detainees at that military prison were arrested on, well, the New York Times called it, highly subjective evidence. There was one case where poor farmers were captured when they were seen wearing a style of watch or a type of jacket that was the same watch or jacket that was worn by Al-Qaeda terrorists. People who had done nothing. These were just farmers. Yet those and those innocent farmers may still be in Guantanamo among the 80-some prisoners who have already been cleared for release because they didn't do anything wrong. And we've imprisoned and tortured them for 6 years. More than 6 years. And the mainstream media also missed reports that U.S. military officials deliberately withheld information about the killings of two Reuters staff members, the two Reuters photographers, and a dozen innocent civilians in Baghdad back in 2007, July 12th to be exact. It was that video, when that video got released, when Bradley Manning took that video and put it on WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks put it out, and it got played by the media in the United States for a short while. Everybody now seems to have forgotten that came from Bradley Manning. That not only was what was kind of a tipping point in terms of our saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe this war really isn't all that good, and maybe we're not doing the best stuff over there. Here we are killing innocent civilians and journalists. But it also started our government's efforts to hunt down Bradley Manning. bottom line here is that while the U.S. government is using Bradley Manning as a scapegoat for their own less than desirable actions, our mainstream media is letting them get away with it by not doing their jobs, not reporting on the real significance. In the next week or so, Bradley Manning is virtual certainty going to get a very long prison sentence. The news came out today that his lawyers were arguing that many of the charges against him are duplicative, that they're, you know, he's being charged three or four different ways and times for the exact same crime. And the judge agreed today and said, okay, the maximum that we're looking at right now is 90 years. Right. Now, he still hasn't been sentenced. It may be considerably less than that, but it's going to be, well, I shouldn't pre-guess. We'll see where it's going to go. But in the meantime, our mainstream media really needs to wake up and report. I mean, this is supposed to be their job, to report the real significance of Manning's actions. And you and I, we should all be watching and listening. We should be paying careful attention to this to say, you know, when is our media going to start talking about what actually happened? I mean, you can agree or disagree with, you know, Bradley Manning. I, you know, one of the points that the guy from the State Department made yesterday was that, you know, the State Department is finding that some diplomats are reluctant to talk to American diplomats because, you know, might get released by some future Bradley Manning in diplomatic cables. Well, you know, welcome to the real world. If there wasn't stuff in those cables that indicated that our government had been committing crimes and lying to us, I personally am convinced, and I hope the judge in Manning's case is as well, that Bradley Manning never would have released that information. He didn't do this to make money. He didn't do it out of malice. He did it because he believed in a United States of America that held itself to the high standards that it has proclaimed for 200 years and that has consistently, generation after generation after generation for those 200 plus years, gotten better. We ended slavery. Women got the vote. I mean, we're still a long way in terms of race relations and misogyny and equal pay for equal work. We still have a ways to go. But every generation, until the Bush administration, it had been getting better and better in this country. Our republic had become more and more open. Our systems of governance had become, well, you know, you can say we've had some problems since Reagan, but. In fact, I'd say we've had a lot of problems since Reagan. But the security stuff, I mean, when we genuinely went insane was right after 9/11, when George W. Bush and Dick Cheney were so terrified that they went to the intelligence agencies and said, please save us from that big bad man. I don't care if we have to give up our civil liberties. Please save us. And the NSA said, sure, we'll save you. Just let us look under the bed of every American. No problem. You know, you just shouldn't make those kind of deals.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And I'm convinced that if Cheney and Bush had had the kind of courage that previous presidents have had, like Bill Clinton faced with Tim McVeigh, we wouldn't be here now. Bees on the roof of a building in New York City. Anyway, pardon me while I'm browsing the New York Times. Chris in Erie, Colorado, listening on KKZN. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom? So, you know, I've been trying to call the show for quite a while to give you my thought on a solution to illegal immigration. And you've always said that employers are the real criminals in this country that hire on the illegal. So I kind of came up with a solution about 2 years ago. And that is to put a public service announcement out there, or some sort of newspaper ad, online ad, whatever, that says that, hey, if you go to ICE, if you go to the IRS, and you turn in your employer, and you tell them, you show proof that they're hiring illegals,
that I think ICE should grant you amnesty and maybe 4 and 5 of your buddies or family members, and then, you know, they can turn in their employer. And then I think once they do that, that the IRS says that, hey, once you been caught hiring illegals and they kind of do a little internal audit, and I think that all those payroll taxes that they've been writing off all those years of hiring illegal aliens, I think they should have to pay that back. And I think overnight employers will be scared out of their mind, you know, have to pay those taxes back, that they're not going to hire illegals. You know, you're going to almost make everybody legal here because they're
going to... Well, this is how it was before the Reagan presidency, Chris, before 86 when Reagan had his amnesty program. Prior to that, if employers hired people who were not citizens, they went to jail. Not the people who were not citizens, but the employers. Or they got very, very large fines. And, you know, after the Reagan amnesty, you saw the population of people working in meatpacking plants and working in low-skilled jobs like, I don't want to call carpentry low-skilled because a union carpenter is a highly skilled person, but just the, you know, the basic construction industries, you saw that very rapidly change. From union, high-skill, high-wage American citizens to low-skill, low-wage recent immigrants from you know, a variety of countries, principally from the south of here.
Right.
And the simple reason for it was because the meatpacking companies knew that, you know, Reagan was not going to throw them in jail. And the big developers knew that Reagan wasn't going to throw them in jail. And
well, I guess your solution now would be to prosecute these guys, or, I mean, what would be a... I know this.
I see a two-step, a very simple two-step solution, Chris. First of all, you've got a lot of people who came here because they were looking for jobs. They wanted to better themselves. They wanted to better their families. Those are the kind of immigrants this country actually wants and needs. People who take initiative. People who are willing to take a chance for a better life, right? I mean, those are the kind. That's like back in the day, the people who took a ship all the way across the Atlantic, you know, back when 5% of the ships went down. Those are the kind of people that you want as immigrants. They're here, and they're, you know, actually over the last 3 years they have not been increasing their numbers. In fact, they've been going back south more than they've been coming up north because the economy has been so bad. But they're here, but they're being paid crap wages because the employers know that they can exploit these people. They know that they can threaten them with turning them over to ICE, and the employers know that the employers themselves will never go to jail if they do that. So you've got people who are, you know, the whole spectrum from sexual exploitation to physical exploitation to having their wages stolen to being forced to work for, you know, for pennies on the dollar. And what would happen is over this 13-year period that the both Republicans and Democrats are proposing is for legalization is, first of all, you're not going to have a big influx of people into the workforce. They're already here. What's going to happen is that, A, you're going to stop new people coming in because you're going to start enforcing those laws against illegal employers. The minute you do that, you stop it. You don't need a border fence, right? I mean, the border fence, the 5, 20, 30 billion, whatever it is, border fence, that's just a welfare program for Texas and Arizona, for Jan Brewer and Rick Perry. But as soon as you start putting employers in jail, people will stop coming because there won't be jobs available for them, number one. Number two, you're going to see the wages of people once they become legal workers, and these people will get the equivalent of a green card during that 13-year period. Once they become legal workers, you can see their wages rise to at least the minimum wage, which is going to shift the floor. It's going to raise the floor underneath low-skilled labor across the United States. You're going to see wages in general go up. As wages go up, people at the bottom will have more money in their pockets to buy things. When they buy things out in the marketplace, because these people spend 100% of their income on, you know, just the daily necessities, they stimulate the economy. As the economy gets stimulated and as wages go up, tax collections go up, the deficit goes down, the economy gets better, and as the economy is stimulated and there's more demand for goods and services because people are making decent wages now, employers are going to say, wow, we got to produce more of these. We got to produce more shirts and more jeans and more cars and more all these things that people are buying, and so we need to hire more people. And so hiring goes up. It goes from a destructive downward spiral into a virtuous spiral. So I think that a rational program to integrate these folks into our, I mean, they're already integrated into our workforce, to legally recognize their participation in our workforce so that their employers can no longer pay them $3 an hour and are going to have to start paying them at least $7.25 an hour, coupled with a raise in the minimum wage to $9 or $10 an hour, would just be an amazing, wonderful thing for the United States. Am I making sense, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. There's one more really quick thing. You had a caller yesterday that had mentioned that about the MIAC report and the international cabal of banksters. He just sounded like an Alex Jones listener. And I found what you said to be kind of interesting, and I wanted you to clarify. He was talking about going off on the land and growing his own food and arming up and individual liberty. And you had mentioned that you thought the community would be, you know, if there was some big cabal and a new world order and, you know, quack, 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 Alex Jones, that how would that community come together to overthrow the, quote, conspiracy?
I don't think it's a matter of coming together to overthrow it any more than a lone individual with a basement full of AR-14s is going to overthrow it. I think it's you know, making your way through it. I think that we come together as a community called the United States of America to, you know, through political action and activity to say, okay, enough already. We're going to pass a constitutional amendment saying that, you know, corporations are not persons and billionaires don't have free speech because they got more dollars, you know, more free speech, that sort of thing. But I do think that if you look at, I know, you look at the history of the United States, it's always been community that drove everything. Davy Crockett couldn't have gone out in the wilderness unless he'd had community behind him, unless he'd been raised by a family and by a community, and everything he had was made by community. So it's community is what... We're humans. We're social animals. Community is what always wins.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Hillary Clinton said it takes a village. It's really true. We'll be right back. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very nephilogenously ugly, the good. Habitat for Humanity, the Aussie nonprofit, won a big victory for the climate earlier this summer when it finished construction on the Empower House here in Washington, D.C. Designed by a group of architecture students, the house is outfitted with energy-efficient paneling and windows that help retain heat. Because it's built with more efficient materials, the Empower House doesn't require as many expensive solar panels as other environmentally friendly homes. Its asking price is around $200,000, comparable with other homes in the neighborhood. Good work, Habitat for Humanity. The bad. The Koch brothers, or the Koch brothers, as you choose. There's a big black cloud hanging over Detroit, and no, it's not the city's pending bankruptcy proceedings. It's waste from the Alberta tar sands. Every day, Koch Industries purchases tons upon tons of high-carbon, high-sulfur petroleum coke left over from tar sands oil extraction and ships it down the Great Lakes, storing it at a port along the Detroit River. To make matters worse, the wind often blows the coke all over the river and into the surrounding neighborhoods. As if Detroit didn't already have enough problems, now it has solidified tar sands waste whipping through its streets. Good job, Koch Brothers. And the very, very ugly, the Hunger Games camp. A summer camp in Largo, Florida has a great idea for summertime fun, fight to the death. At the end of every week, counselors gather together their campers and organize them into teams. The counselors then order the kids to hunt their rivals down and kill them. The game is based on the popular movie The Hunger Games, but parents and educators think this fantasy is far too real. They say it teaches kids that violence is fun and rewarding, and they have a point. The last thing kids these days need is more exposure to violence. They get it every day on TV. They certainly don't need it at summer camp. This is just very, very ugly. Oh, here's an interesting one. Ever heard of Borja Gutierrez? Borja Gutierrez is the mayor of a little town called Brunete in Spain. And they had a problem, as people do in cities all over the world, with people not, shall we say, cleaning up after their dogs. And they'd tried imposing fines on people, but hey, the economy's so bad, you know, a quarter of the population's unemployed, people aren't paying fines, and, you know, it'll just upset people even worse. So he organized a group of volunteers. It didn't cost the city anything. People volunteered for this. To hang out near the public parks, and when somebody didn't clean up after their dog, as the person was walking away and just about to go out of sight, run over, grab the dog poo, put it in a bag, and then follow the person home. Write down their address, and about 2 hours later, a delivery person comes and delivers a nice gift box with the seal of the city on it and is stamped lost and found. Deliver it to their door. And people go, oh, lost and found. Well, thank you very much. Take it in their house. You know, 3 minutes later, ah! So, it's working really well, actually. In fact, the mayor, this is the funniest line in this whole story. This is the New York Times today. He's talking with the mayor of Madrid, and she sits down next to him, and Mr. Gutierrez said, she said, well, not many mayors think sending dog poop to voters is a good idea. How did you dare? And he said, well, you know, we had to do something. But it seems to be making him popular, so having clean streets and parks was a big deal. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, thanks for calling. What's up?
Oh, good afternoon, Tom. Love to hear your show every day.
Thank you.
Just have a couple things on my mind. First thing was I live in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
But through the Internet, I can get Orlando news. And one thing that they said was the banks, the Florida legislature, they passed through a bill that not too many people know about that gave amnesty to banks here in Florida as far as the foreclosure scandal that they had. And they're already poised right now to that they feel like another housing bubble is on the rise.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Right here in Florida.
I think it's happening all over the country.
Right, exactly. And I'd like to say hi to President Obama because I know he's listening to your show as well. Today, proof positive, last week I called Senator Sanders was on, and I explained that immigration has a lot to do with everything in this country. Like, that's the number one bill that has to be passed.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that he did say in his speech that was only covered on NBC, Fox didn't cover it, and CNN wasn't covering it nationally, was that immigration has a big role also in the housing bubble.
Mm-hmm.
In the housing. Right.
Yeah.
And, go ahead.
No, you're right. I was just agreeing with you.
Definitely. One thing that I've never had a chance to talk to you about, just shifting gears, was last year, in the vice presidential nomination and debate with Martha Raddatz, in the seventh minute of the program, Paul Ryan actually said that Iran was no closer to an atomic weapon that they was, you know, that they've been propaganda.
Yeah.
They had the propaganda.
Yeah, Charles, your phone is breaking up really badly. I'm sorry, and I should have limited you to one topic. We typically just my apologies, but I've got to move along here. Michelle in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Michelle, you have a strategy for progressive town hall meetings?
Yes, I do. Since the progressives, left leaning free thinkers, don't stand a chance at the Republican based town hall meetings, I propose that people who are running against those people in office set up their own town hall meeting. There's no laws that say you can't.
Yeah.
It's a public, open to the public. So set up an alternative town hall meeting.
I have suggested this in the past that in some countries, and I believe the UK and Australia, I may be wrong, but in some countries, the opposition party, the principal opposition party, will set up what they call a shadow government. And they'll have a shadow, minister of foreign affairs and minister of the interior and whatever. And those people actually don't have any power or authority. They just kind of play the role. But they will make proclamations about what they would have done if they were in power so that the people can see the contrast as the administration goes along. And I've said for a long time that we should be setting up, particularly in those states that are Republican controlled, But, hey, I don't mind if the Republicans do it and say it's democratically controlled if it increases the dialogue of actual ideas rather than just name-calling, where the opposition party sets up a shadow government and they say, okay, you're going to do it that way. This is how we would do it. I mean, that's principally what we've been lacking from the Republicans. They never say this is what we would do. They just say, we don't like what you're doing, and we're going to shut down the government. But I think your suggestion has considerable merit, and that would be one way to do it. So thanks, Michelle. Thanks for the call. Cora in Taos, New Mexico, listening on KVOT. Hey, Cora, what's up?
Well, I was just thinking that maybe Reuters had an incentive to investigate this SOD part of the DEA, considering it was their correspondents that were killed in that tape that Bradley Manning uncovered.
I doubt they're, well, maybe they're,
I mean, you know,
I don't see the straight line.
Sorry. You know, it's, you know, it certainly would give them an incentive.
Yeah.
You know, here you have Bradley Manning being accused of, you know, doing this, you know, spy thing, and here the government's been spying thing.
Right, right.
And nobody has really paid for that except for Bradley Manning.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, now Ed Snowden and Mr. Julian Assange as well. So, interesting, because the DEA's SOD division, the Special Operations Division, and a caller earlier pointed out SOD is grass, haha, DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration. Anyhow, the SOD division actually gets a lot of their information from the NSA, and it's a way of the NSA, which is not supposed to operate inside the United States, to funnel money or funnel information into domestic spy agencies who then funnel it to local police departments who then cover it up and don't even tell judges and prosecutors. And it's all very, very bizarre. And I think that you may be right. Reuters may feel a little burned, and they might be more enthusiastic about outing government malfeasance. Good point, Cora. Thank you for the call. Brandon in Riverside, California. Brandon, we got a minute till the break. It's yours.
Okay. First, I was wanting to point out that every time I hear somebody kind of criticizing Ronald Reagan, they're always using a lot of, you know, factual things that he said, like, you know, the fact that he said that trees cause pollution and just these ridiculous things that he's done.
Right.
And then when I see the conservatives say that he's a hero and all this and that, I don't know what they're basing it on. Do you know?
Well, they say he cut taxes, and he did cut the top tax rate for billionaires, but he raised taxes 17 times. So, you know, he criticized black people and poor people. I mean, he kicked off his presidential campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is where three civil rights workers were murdered, a little town of 7,000 people back in the 60s. And he was talking about states' rights, which used to be the metaphor, still is, I guess, for no federal laws against discrimination. So, you know, maybe he's just, you know, I get it where the white supremacists would love him. And the billionaires would love them, but everybody else, not so much. Thanks, Brandon, for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What I think is really interesting is now that we've had some time to reflect on the Reagan presidency, more and more Republicans and conservatives are just saying, you know, we never loved Reagan. Talk media for the sane among us. It's the Tom Hartman Program, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tina in Jay, New York. Hey, Tina, you wanted to talk about the anniversary of Hiroshima and the VRA, the Voting Rights Act?
Yeah, I just thought that to remind us of the full circle of life, how short our memory is.
Yeah.
Yes, today is the day that we bombed Hiroshima. We forget that we're the only power in the world to have used a nuclear weapon. But you talk often about that point where the reality is so far short of our expectation that we'll rise up and do something about it. And I can't help but feel a bit deflated because Iraq should have been that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Fallujah and those children born with defects that we can't even imagine should have been that moment. Bradley Manning facing death should have been that moment. And the moments go on and on, and I don't know if there's a big enough moment left. I just don't know. So I thought I would contribute that, yes, today's the anniversary of Hiroshima, the anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. It's also Lord Alfred Tennyson's birthday.
Okay. Thank you, Tina. I think that people will wake up. I think that it's going to take a bit more of a shock and probably a serious economic shock, which is inevitable, in my opinion, because we have not fixed the basic problems that caused the last crash. which was, you know, it's the same thing that happened in 1920 when Harding came into office and changed the dynamic. He put Reaganomics into place in 1920. He had 9 years of the Roaring Twenties and then a crash. Reagan put Reaganomics in a far more gradual way, but essentially the same thing. And then we ended up with this crash, and we're only halfway through it. So, and I think that that's going to be the waking up point. But, you know, time will tell. I hope that I'm wrong. I hope that we can come out of this and everything is just hunky-dory. But, yeah, we have a lot of work to do, and you did a very good job of pointing out. Also, if we're thinking of the anniversary of Hiroshima, we need to remember that Fukushima right now is leaking, and the Japanese Atomic Energy Agency, or their equivalent of that, just came out and said it's an emergency and they don't know what to do about it. There are two of those reactors that apparently are experiencing a China syndrome kind of meltdown, and it's got them freaked out. We'll be talking about that tonight on TV. Tina, thank you for the call. Dan, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. Dan, you wanted to talk about cancer rates?
Oh, I'm sorry. She asked me what the station I was listening to. He said Albuquerque, but I'm actually in California.
So ah, okay. Okay.
So sorry about that.
Quite all right.
But in any case, yeah, just a couple things. Somebody called earlier, and I'm the healthcare professional, and said that, you know, a lot of these foods are causing more cancers and everything. Mm-hmm. Actually, the cancer rates are dropping.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, mortality is dropping in a lot of cancers. So if we look at statistics over, it's about 1999,
mm-hmm.
there's a significant drop for, if you group all cancers. Now, of course, some are on the rise, but as a
right.
whole, they have dropped.
Do you think that's because the EPA has been effective at detoxifying our environment over the last 30 years?
I think it's just better medical care, earlier
detection,
finding out of a diagnosis, that kind of thing. I think that this past year we had the highest number of drugs approved were chemo drugs, but some of those have not got to, you know, they're brand new and have not been used that much. The other thing, as far as genetically engineered meats and foods and things like that, I really don't worry about that. I mean, a molecule is a molecule. An atom is an atom. I mean, if it's the same structure, whether it's natural or man-made, it doesn't matter. What does matter is if there's other junk in the food. If there's mercuries, or you were mentioned toxins, biphenyls, eating fatty fish 3 or 4 times a week maybe, those kind of things, yes. But as far as meat, excluding fat problems,
right.
but a protein is a protein. It's the same structure, so it doesn't matter. But those are my comments. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay.
And if
you said it well, Dan. No, I'll let it stand. I think you did a great job. Thank you. Thank you for the call. Ken in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Dick Cheney?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Ken.
I just... totally agree with you about the immigration issue. I was a Border Patrol agent many years ago, and it was an absurd and dangerous job then. It probably still is.
Yes.
My question to you, sir, is we have been under the thumb, in my opinion, of President Cheney for the last 13 years. How much is he currently making through his no-bid contractors all over the world from this administration? I don't need a... anything but around billion in your firm.
Well, it's a good question. We don't know. I mean, he's also very good at concealing that. The one thing that we do know is that in 1999, when Dick Cheney, I believe it was the year, when Dick Cheney was president of Halliburton, they bought Dresser Industries, which was a company that had a huge asbestos liability, and Cheney thought that he could get around that by, you know, getting Congress to pass some laws or something to help him out, and which he had done in the past on other things. You know, Halliburton, for example, inventing fracking, he got that rule changed. Of course, he was vice president when he got that rule changed. But still, he thought he could help him out, and he couldn't. And Dresser Industries was bankrupting Halliburton. When Dick Cheney was elected vice president of the United States, I think this is the reason why he told George Bush, when Bush went to him and said, help me find a vice presidential nominee, Cheney said, how about me? I think the reason he said that was because he knew that Halliburton was on the verge of bankruptcy and that he was going to be out of a job, and not just out of a job. He was going to be in deep trouble. And so he said, you know, pick me. I'll be vice president. And then when he became vice president, the question was asked, how much stock, Halliburton stock, do you own, and what are you doing with it? And he said, I own 300,000 shares, as I recall. And what I'm going to do with it is none of your damn business. And so I don't know how much he still owns. What I do know is that in the first year of the Bush presidency, Halliburton started getting billions of dollars in no-bid contracts where they didn't have to compete with anybody, and they went from a company being on the edge of bankruptcy and total and utter failure, driven into the ground by Dick Cheney's business decisions, to being a very, very wealthy and, you know, a company that's spinning off huge profits for their stockholders like Dick Cheney. So I'm with you, Ken. I get it. But I can't give you a number. I'm sorry. Coming up tomorrow, Thomas Jefferson said our liberty demands freedom of the press. Just how free is our press today? I'll have a conversation with First Amendment rights attorney James Goodale, author of Fighting for the Press. Plus, is America on the way to becoming a police state? I'll challenge libertarian John Whitehead. And remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. You have to get out there and show up. Occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.